Hi, this is Irene Friedman, and the program is...
It's All About Animals!
Yes, it is, and we'll be starting out with some jokes today, and then, since I finished the Ginger Pie book, I have a new book. It's called Tell Me Where It Hurts, and it's by Dr. Nick Trout, and it's his experience as a veterinarian at the Angel Veterinary Hospital. And then there's something from Catster Magazine, and we'll see how far we get after that. But right now, we're going to get started with the jokes.
Trout. I've heard that name before someplace. It's not Levi Trout, is it?
Isn't there Mike Trout, the baseball player?
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. Not Levi Trout.
No.
Named after, like, the jeans or something.
No.
Okay. Well, I guess it's time for the jokes,
Yes,
huh?
It is, and you may get started.
I think I already was, but what did the turkey sing on Thanksgiving Day? What did the turkey sing on Thanksgiving Day?
Gobble? Gobble? Gobble, gobble?
I would like to hear that sometime, but nope, I haven't heard that song.
Beat the drumsticks?
Nope.
What did the turkey... I don't think he was singing. I think he was cooked.
His goose was cooked, wasn't it?
What did the did he sing on Thanksgiving?
Well, it's what did the turkeys sing on Thanksgiving? I mean, it's just not one turkey. It's like the turkeys, a choir.
Rescue me.
Oh, yes.
Rescue me. Ooh, by Fontana Bass.
That's a pretty good one,
okay,
right there.
That's my answer.
Well, nope. That's not what I'm looking for.
Well, what were you looking for?
I'll tell you. What did the turkey sing on Thanksgiving Day? God save the kin.
But isn't that the British national anthem? So in
Well, kin, K-I-N, not king. Kin.
Yeah.
Yep.
But aren't it's sort of a play on that word.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know if turkeys would even know that song.
Oh,
since
yeah.
Since it's sort of an American holiday.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. But, you know, they spend a lot of time overseas.
Okay. Okay. I was trying to think of a witty comeback, but I'm at a loss for words. Okay. Who is a lamb's favorite superhero?
Who is a lamb's favorite superhero? A lamb's. Mary, probably, because she had a little lamb.
Yes, she did.
She was kind of a superhero.
I don't know if she would be a superhero.
A superhero. A lamb superhero. Probably not Batman.
Oh, you're so close.
Oh, yes.
It's Batman.
I didn't even get a chance to say, give it to me.
Well, sorry I jumped the gun.
Oh, that's okay. I do that occasionally myself.
Your turn.
Okay. I know you're going to get this one because you've heard this before.
We've heard a lot of animal jokes.
Yes, we have. Okay. Why did the police arrest the turkey? Why did the police... Arrest the turkey.
I think I have heard this. So
yes,
I'm going
you have.
Blank.
Oh, no. Oh. I'd expect me to say that. I'm going blank, but, you know, I...
Oh, I know this, but I don't know this. Why did the police arrest the turkey?
Why did the police arrest the turkey?
I think it has the word gobble in it.
Nope.
No?
Nope. Why did the police arrest the turkey?
I'm at a loss for words.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, why did the police arrest the turkey? Well, because they suspected him of foul play.
Oh, gosh. Okay, I think I've seen something similar about chickens. Well, you should be saving these for Thanksgiving. Okay.
Yes, I probably should
yes.
be. Maybe you'll get them
Maybe
again.
Maybe you'll get reruns.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
What do you get when you cross a rabbit with Cinderella?
What do I get when I cross a rabbit with Cinderella? Well, you know, she probably wouldn't be late for her carriage changing because she'd just be hopping right over there to it.
That is correct.
Yes.
That is correct.
But that's probably not the correct
that
answer.
That is not even close to the correct answer.
Okay, so...
What do you get when you cross a rabbit with Cinderella?
You have something that, hops. She hops. Cinderella hops.
Nope.
Mm. Well, Irene, I guess I'm at a loss for words myself.
I guess you could say she danced a hip-hop at the ball.
Oh, yeah, you could say that.
But what do you get when you cross the rail with Cinderella? A hair ball. Okay, we have time for one more round.
Okay, what kind of turkey grows on a tree? I think you're going to get this. What kind of turkey grows on a tree? This isn't really a holiday joke, so you don't have to worry about cranberry sauce or anything like that. But kind of turkey grows on a tree?
A Cornish hen?
Nope. Nope.
That's
pretty good.
Clever, yeah.
That's pretty good.
What kind of turkey grows on a tree?
Yes.
Some nuts?
Yeah, maybe. There's probably some nuts up there if you look real close.
Acorns, nuts, pine trees.
Nope, pine nuts. Nope, not even pine nuts.
Maple flavored?
Nope.
I don't know.
What kind of turkey grows on a tree? A poultry.
Oh. Oh, that's very good. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, you're making my stomach hurt.
Okay,
I'm laughing
so
much.
I know. Well, here's my last joke, and it's not an animal joke, because this book is just chock full of jokes that are funny, but not animal jokes. Why did the boy eat the lamp?
Why did the boy eat the lamp? Because he couldn't
remember,
eat.
It's not an animal joke. Why did the boy eat the lamp?
So there's nothing in there about a rabbit or a cat or anything.
No, no, no.
Okay. Why did the boy eat the lamp? That was a question, I guess. Okay. Because he wanted to see what he was eating. I would have just turned the light on, I think. But
Nope.
He wanted to. Why did the boy eat the lamp? Because he could be kerosene. His name was maybe Caro. He could be seen.
Wasn't a kerosene lamp?
Oh, what kind of lamp was it?
Do you give?
I give.
Not what kind of lamp it is, because I don't know.
Oh.
Why did the boy eat the lamp?
Because it was magic.
Nope.
Nope.
His mother told him to have a light snack. That's pretty good, wasn't
that it? Is pretty
yeah,
good,
that was,
yes.
So like I said, so I might have to get some non-animal jokes in because Jokopedia is full of them.
That's okay. Yep.
Well, that concludes the joke segment
All
of
right,
the program.
I'm going to go back and have me a light snack.
Okay. Enjoy.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Thank you so much. And now we're going to turn to the New York Times bestseller, Tell Me Where It Hurts by Dr. Nick Trout. Let me see what the copyright is on this. This was written 2008. And here's the author's note. The tales you're about to read are the truth, practically the truth, and nothing less than a half-truth sifted from recollections of thousands of animal encounters over the course of the last 25 years. The vast majority of these stories happen to me. Where possible, I have turned to the patient's medical record for accuracy and specifics. Many instances, I have gone back and interviewed the owners, filling in the gaps, getting at overlooked and unspoken perspectives that I miss when working the clinical aspects of the case. Frequently, I alter names and identifying traits, occasionally preserving a memorable and characteristic idiosyncrasy by trading it among pets and owners to maintain anonymity, except where certain individuals have insisted their identity be revealed. There are a few anecdotes that have been narrated to me by my colleagues. I have taken copious notes, attempted to rein in my imagination, sometimes with limited success, and endeavored to preserve the essence of their messages. Finally, in an attempt to capture the pace, the rush, and the intensity of all that is new in 21st century veterinary medicine, I have squeezed everything into a single day. Please think of it as nothing more than the vehicle that takes you on this journey. I could have opted for a sleepy ride across the state of Kansas in the back of a chauffeur-driven limo. I hope you prefer a buzz across Boston on the back of a moped at rush hour. And the chapters are quite long. The print is rather small, so these chapters will be divided up into a few weeks at a time to get through a chapter. Chapter 1, 2:47 a.m., wake-up call. This might seem strange coming from an Englishman, but sometimes emergency surgery in the middle of the night can play out like a synopsis of a perfect season for the Boston Red Sox. The beginning may be predictably crappy, slow, discombobulated until a rhythm develops and momentum builds, leaving you stricken with that familiar glimmer of hope. When it comes to the final stretch, everyone accepts that there may be failure, there may be disappointment, but the struggle is always gritty and memorable. And occasionally, if you're really lucky, something magical will happen. My beginning came half an hour earlier with a phone call reeling me in from a cozy, dreamless void. "Hello," I said, two disjointed syllables caught in a sticky web at the back of my throat. "This is Dr. Keene, one of the new surgical residents. We haven't met, but I've got a dog, a 10-year-old spayed female German shepherd. She's bloated and, I need you to come in for the surgery. Sorry." All I heard was sound, not words I could interpret, my brain dormant on my pillow. "Hello, are you still there?" "Yeah, sure, I'm listening," I croaked, wiping a palm across my face. "What time is it?" She told me and dove into her apology. "I really hate to disturb you, but, my backup's not answering his pager, and, I didn't know what else to do." Her words surfed through me, a valley girl inflection, and sluggish gray matter dug out a memory of a recent departmental memo. "Be sure to welcome our first-year surgery resident, Dr. Sarah Keene from the University of California, Davis." I came awake, sat up in bed, and told my wife to go back to sleep. "No problem, Dr. Keene. Tell me about your GDV. As a new surgery resident, Dr. Keene may know all about GDV, an acronym that stands for gastric dilatation and volvulus, commonly referred to with a satisfying rustic flavor as bloat. But more than likely, at this stage in her training, her understanding is primarily academic. Words and phrases in a textbook, disease as bullets of information and shocking fluorescent pink highlights. She will be a year out from veterinary school, a year in which she will probably have diagnosed and managed several cases of GDV. She knows all about this bizarre anatomical aberration and the inevitable rampant pathology it will incite. She even knows exactly what needs to be done, but until now, until tonight, she has never been the one who actually picks up a scalpel and makes the cure happen. Tonight, for the first time in her professional career, she is the surgeon on call, and not surprisingly, she is in need of some help. GDV is a true veterinary surgical emergency. It typically occurs in deep-chested dogs like German Shepherds, Great Danes, and Standard Poodles, but on occasion, I've even seen it in breeds as small as Dachshunds. No one is entirely sure why it happens, but oftentimes the animal eats a large meal, gets some exercise, and an hour or so later, the problems begin. Fermented gas starts to accumulate in the distended stomach, and for whatever reason, the entire organ twists around and flips over on its long axis. The effect is catastrophic. The twist blocks off the esophagus, so despite the poor creature's desire to throw up and rid itself of all the food and gas, nothing will budge. The stomach expands unchecked, destroying its own blood supply, driving into the chest and squashing the lungs and the blood flow back to the heart. There's no absolute timetable for how long an animal can survive in this state, but dogs can die in a matter of hours. As soon as the diagnosis is made, the clock is ticking. She got a full bag of kibble around 7. Owner took her for a walk before bed. He could hear the dog trying to vomit unsuccessfully around midnight and drove her all the way up from the Cape. She looks ready to explode. Classic double bubble on abdominal x-rays. I have been waiting for this description, the twisted, distended stomach looking like the silhouette of a giant heavyweight's boxing glove on an x-ray. It tells me her diagnosis is correct. "Is she stable?" I asked. "Not really," said Dr. Keene. "Her pressures are through the floor. We're having a hell of a time just finding a decent vein, let alone placing a catheter." My feet were swinging out of the bed, and I began to fumble for clean clothes. "Do your best. Try to pass the stomach tube. I'll be there as fast as I can." Angel Animal Medical Center, part of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, is located in the eclectic and increasingly gentrified Boston neighborhood of Jamaica Plain. There are no world rankings of veterinary hospital size, but at 185,000 square feet, I imagine Angel is one of the larger ones, with over 70 veterinarians serving nearly 50,000 dogs, cats, and exotic pets every year. After 10 years on staff as a surgeon, I know those nasty rumors about Boston traffic are all subterfuge because at 3 in the morning, an easy commute is rewarded with my pick from one of the primo parking spots close to the front door. It is January in New England. There are a couple of inches of snow on the ground. A miniature version of the Andes has been plowed against the perimeter wall, and today's high will be only 10 below. I walked across the salted asphalt like a geriatric with a bad case of hemorrhoids, poised to slip on the black ice. Despite the hour, my sleepiness is starting to burn off like fog on an imaginary sunny morning as I enter this five-story brick building and head toward the non-sterile surgical prep area. The corridors are empty, floors polished, phones silent, and pagers dead. I have entered an antiseptic ghost town, and I like the way it feels. It reminds me of being a kid again, of breaking into the neighbor's backyard in order to steal the ripe apples taunting me from their tree. The mission is covert, even risky, all but guaranteeing the rewards will make it worthwhile. Cutting through the radiology department, I catch a glimpse of my reflection in the glass window outside the MRI unit. The man I see looks unfamiliar. He has piggy eyes, a pillow crease scar across his left cheek, and a jaunty case of bedhead. Thank goodness my patients never judge me on my appearance. My patient lies splayed across a large gurney, nervous nails clawing for purchase on the stainless steel surface. She is a big girl, obviously not lacking for love in the calorie department. Her darting chocolate eyes scream in fear of her strange situation, and the change is taking place in her body, but as I enter the room and approach, her broad and bushy tail offers me a couple of friendly beats. I like German shepherds. I grew up with one as a kid, but this gesture strikes me as both uncharacteristic and, at the same time, utterly endearing. Until this moment, I've been dealing with an anonymous and remote animal reduced to a list of diseases, conditions, problems, and deformities. Suddenly, everything has changed. This animal has a name and a personality. This animal has become my patient. This is the moment when I begin to care. I pat her head and run my hand across a soft, velvety ear over her chest and down to the enormous, unyielding abnormality that is her drum-tight abdomen. Hi, sweetheart, you hanging in there? For me, all my patients are sweethearts until proven otherwise, whether they are male or female, cute and cuddly Himalayan kittens, or slobbering and stoic, 250 pounds of bull mastiff. Holding a needle and syringe, Dr. Keene, a short, shiny-faced woman with blonde hair and a ponytail, turns to me. She can be no more than 25. I wonder if at 43 I'm getting a little long in the tooth for this game. She glares through sparkly green contacts as though she thought I had been addressing her. I introduce myself, offer my hand, and assure her that I was speaking to her patient. This is Sage, she says, trying to apply an oxygen mask to the dog's snout. I'm Sarah, and this is Dan. She gestures to a technician I have never met before, although this is not surprising given the hour. For most of us working in a busy animal hospital, being on call for surgical emergencies every other night, every other weekend, is simply not sustainable for more than a couple of years. Nocturnal surgical emergencies are a rite of passage, an inherent requisite in any decent residency program, a privilege to be endured and enjoyed. But now, nearly 15 years after the completion of my training, my midnight forays into the OR are limited to the 1 week in every month that I am available as backup to the residents. Dan juts a square chin in my direction and gives me a casual sup. He has a pierced right eyebrow and lower lip with colorful sleeves of tattoos running down his arms in perfect contrast to the sallow vampire skin of his face. In different surroundings, he might attract attention, but here, working the overnight, he can relax, setting up the EKG leads, sorting out the pulse oximeter, and adjusting the intravenous fluids with an experienced hand. There's a small shaved square on Sage's flank where an attempt has been made to release the trapped and expanding gas in the dog's stomach by directly puncturing the organ with a large bore needle. I touch the small red bullseye in the center of the bald spot. The skin is impossibly taut. Clearly, the attempt failed. No luck with the tube, I ask, although I know the question is redundant. If they had successfully passed the stomach tube, the preferred method of decompression, there would have been no need to try to use a needle. Dr. Keene shakes her head. I'm afraid not, she says. She's in bad shape. Heart rate's 220 with occasional VPCs. Her color looks like shit. I'm not surprised. The shock to Sage's circulation has convinced her heart that she is running an endless sprint. This effect, combined with the absorption of toxic byproducts via the damaged stomach, can produce runs of abnormal and ineffective heartbeats called VPCs, or ventricular premature contractions. Heard over a heart monitor, VPCs make the beat of a frenetic African tribal dance sound like the chord changes of funeral march. They can be disastrous in their own right. And that's where I'm going to stop for today. And we'll pick up with that incident next week. Like I said, these chapters are long and the print is small, so maybe 4 weeks to get through each chapter. But right now I'm going to move on to something in Catster Magazine. Again, our new book, Tell Me Where It Hurts by Dr. Nick Trout. But right now, in Catster Magazine, Boys Versus Girls by Rita Reimers. This comes under the Mind and Body New Catitude section. Over the many years I've spent working at various adoption events, I occasionally heard people voice preferences for adopting one sex over another. I never thought too deeply about gender-specific behavior differences among cats until a recent experience with a client. Since she knows I am connected with many local rescues, one of her clients at Just for Cats told me she was looking for a new kitty to adopt. One of her boy cats had passed away and she wanted to adopt a new pal for her remaining orange boy. I knew of a young orange female who was available for adoption, but my client said she really wanted another boy. After thinking about my own cat household, her reasoning became clear, as you'll see. For me, I always took in the kitties who needed a home fast because they were in dire straits or the ones who chose me at an adoption event and wouldn't let go of me. And then in parentheses, I've been chosen plenty of times, lucky for me, but undeniably, there are some behavior differences between male and female cats in general. Living in my private 20-cat rescue, coupled with over 50 years of both rescue experience and working with thousands of kitties in other people's homes, I have been given some pretty clear insight into the behaviors of many cats, male and female alike. Boys will be boys. There are some basic differences in the way male and female cats behave that are largely centered around their hormones. For example, an intact male cat has a very strong urge to reproduce. Male cats have been known to literally break screens to get out or in order to accomplish their mission when there is a female around who is in heat. They are basically slaves to the mating drive. Some behavior and tendencies for unneutered males include roaming, not wanting to stay indoors, marking or which is spraying, and fighting with rival males. After a male cat is neutered, his tendency to roam and wander will greatly diminish, as will his need to fight and mark territory. Neutered males may still engage one another in territory matches, but those will usually be disagreements, not actual fights. Neutered male cats tend to be more loving and accepting of other cats of both sexes, engage in horseplay with their male cat friends and with their people, cuddle with both male and female cats, mark less, although some will spray when feeling threatened or insecure, become deeply bonded to a special cat friend who is usually but not always another male. My Boo Boo and Dash boys are so bonded they cuddle and nurse one another quite often even though they are both fully grown. Sugar and Spice. Intact females, on the other hand, express their hormones a little differently. They tend to become very affectionate, purr and roll around, exposing their tummies, wanting to be petted and loved. She may even present herself to you as she would to a male suitor. Females in heat also vocalize more in order to attract a mate. They generally tolerate more handling when they are in heat, but can also become sexually frustrated and somewhat aggressive. I once had a cat who could not be spayed due to a severe heart murmur. Sometimes she would become so agitated when she was in heat that she would attack my head in the middle of the night, one time narrowly missing my eyes. Some behavior tendencies for unneutered females include loud vocalization, the desire to be handled and petted more, marking their territory with face marking and sometimes spraying, running off rival females from their territory. Once the female is spayed, she will no longer go into heat, so the loud caterwauling and hormonal presentations will cease. She may not want to be handled quite as much, but she will still be affectionate toward other male cats and her chosen people. She may even be somewhat maternal to young kittens, regardless of whether she's had her own litter or not. The maternal drive seems to stay in place for most females. Spayed female cats tend to be a little wary of strange people and animals, which makes sense when you think of her role in the cat family as mom, protector, the young. Not enjoy rough play like their male counterparts do, but they do like to play. Cuddle with a male cat, especially if related, but it is rare to see two female cats cuddling. Remain very territorial, not likely to share certain spots with others, especially with other females. Be more self-reliant than male cats, and they don't always have a special cat buddy. They are more solitary. If they do have a cat friend, it will usually be a male cat and not a female, although my Smoochie and Picasso are proving me wrong right this moment as they are bathing each other, which is a very rare occurrence. Vive la différence. As long as bonding well with people, both male and female cats will bond with their humans equally well. I can tell you that firsthand. My girl kitties love me and snuggle with me just as much as my boy cats. My boys will share me and jump on my lap together or play a game with me at the same time. The girls, however, are not into sharing and will get upset if another cat tries to horn in when we are cuddling or playing. My tiny cat, Smoochie, has my big male cat, Oliver, scared of her because she would loudly scold him whenever he tried to join us on the sofa. So now he won't come near me if she is on my lap or sitting next to me. She's never hurt him, but she's made it quite clear that she's in charge and he is unwelcome. Yes, the female cats most definitely rule the roost. Did I make your decision harder or easier? Only you can decide if gender should be a deciding factor when you are adopting a cat or kitten. I guarantee you will fall in love with the right cat no matter the gender. Either way you choose, you'll have a wonderful feline friend for life when you add a cat to your family. And let's see, devoting her entire life to cats, Rita Reimers is founding owner of JFCats.com, a feline health and wellness company. JF Cats has been providing cat behavior services and cats-only pet sitting for the last 15 years. Rita and her business partner, Linda Hall, are also starting a line of USA-made cat toys and bedding called Gracie and Esther. And you can reach Rita directly on Facebook. And Twitter at The Cat Analyst, and on Instagram at Rita Reimers, The Cat Analyst. And we have about one more minute. If even that, how about something real fast? And here was something out of the Family Dog magazine. Stamp of approval, and I got some of these. Texting and emailing may be the preferred methods of communication these days, which is all the more reason to add a special touch to snail mail correspondence. This year, dog lovers can give a nod to the country's brave military canines through the latest addition to the United States Postal Service's 2019 collection, The Military Working Dogs. The 20-stamp booklet features four breeds commonly bred and trained to be canines: the German Shepherd Dog, Labrador Retriever, Belgian Malinois, and Dutch Shepherd. And these stamps are done in with blue and red backgrounds. The portrait of the dog, a rather stylized portrait, against part of a white star. And they're big stamps and quite attractive. I went to my local post office and got some. Anyway, with that, I am completely out of time. So until next week, this is Irene Friedman, as always, reminding you, spay and neuter those cats and dogs. Thank you for listening, and have a great day and a great week. Bye, everyone.